In this lecture, we're going to tackle how can we assemble amino acids together to make what are called peptide chains, polymers that contain multiple units of amino acids linked together. You already saw in lecture this morning a brief introduction to amino acids. It was a little bit backwards, though, since here's where I'm going to show you a little bit more about structure. So let's cover that structure, and then the reactivity and such that we were dealing with amino acids in lecture, we'll keep that in lecture, but because today's lab is the first step in making one of these peptide chains, that's where we're going to focus today. So we're dealing with alpha amino acids, the simplest one of which we can get by taking acetic acid and simply substituting an amino group at that alpha position. That gives us the molecule glycine, which, since there are two hydrogens also at that alpha position, there is no stereocenter in this molecule. So it's the one amino acid that is not stereogenic. If we put just one alkyl group on there, we've already seen that amino acid in lecture. And that is the amino acid alanine. Now let's draw this in Fischer projection form, which you've already seen that the convention is to put the carbonyl group at the top of a Fischer projection, which means as far as where my eyebrow is, it's going to be on the right-hand side of the paper so I can look at that carbonyl. I want to make the Fischer projection in such a way that the dash and the wedge would end up being my sidearm. And if so, they need to be pointed down towards me. So my eyebrow is going to be on the right. And I'm also going to be looking up at the molecule. If I do so, we end up with, again, the carboxylic acid up top, the amino group down at the bottom. Which side would the methyl group be on? The right, because if I'm looking with my eyebrow to the right-hand side, looking up at the carbonyl, so the dash and wedge are pointed down at me. The dash means it's in the back of the plane, which, from my perspective, is on my right-hand side. And so that means, yes, that the methyl group is going to be on the right. So that's correct, but it's not the standard way to do one of these Fischer projections. The standard way is to have the R group at the bottom, and so that the amino group is either to the left or to the right. So remember, we've done some practice already in twisting the stereocenter around. So I'll rewrite it. Keeping the carboxylic acid at the top, putting the methyl group down below, which now makes that amino group on the left. Which is what makes this L alanine. So let me just make a note off to the side here. So the convention for amino acid Fischer projections is that the acid goes to the top, the R side chain goes at the bottom. And then, as I've shown you over here, when that amino group is on the left, that means it is an L acid. Is the screen unusually clear and bright today somehow? I wonder if they replaced the bulb. That'd be nice. Okay. So, having redrawn this Fischer projection, let's back out of the Fischer projection back to a line structure. So, if I do it the same way that I've been doing carboxylic acids, putting the carbonyl on the right, then it means the methyl group now is going to be in the plane of the paper. And again, looking with my eyebrow at the correct position, since on the Fischer projection, the amino group is now on my left, that's pointed out towards you, which means it's going to be written with a wedge. Now let me show you a series of structures, and you'll see why I'm writing these in just a moment. These are 8 different representations of L-alanine. You notice the top 4 keep the amino group in the plane of the paper, the bottom 4 keep the R group in the plane of the paper. The top 4 represent the carbonyl up to the right, down to the right, up to the left, and down to the left. And similarly, the bottom 4 are up, right, down, right, up, left, bottom. Which means these are the 8 forms I tend to see on exams, which means, yes, any amino acid structure question that I have to grade, I, in principle, have 8 different things I need to search for. Not that you should feel pity, it's just that it's reality. It also, you need to know that you might need to use more than one of these forms depending on what kind of structure you're trying to write. And you'll see that very quickly once we're starting to put amino acids to get. So, I've shown you what an alpha amino acid is, just substituting at that alpha position. The simplest substituent is to have a hydrogen there, which gives us glycine, which is not stereogenic. Then we have all the other amino acids that have the possibility of being in its L or D form. I've shown you L-alanine. Let me just, for comparison's sake, show you 1-D-alanine. To show you it is the enantiomer. All right, so that's an individual amino acid. In lecture, you've already seen the 8 classes of amino acids. The first class is the alkyl group. Having already shown you the alanine and talked about the alkyl group, let me just show you 3 other alkyl group amino acids. This is so that we can have a few simpler amino acids that we could use in synthesis or mechanism examples as they come up. So there's one more, I believe, beyond these, but I'll just put all these alkyl amino acids together. So we already had L-alanine. If we add, or if we have, instead of a methyl group, we have an isopropyl group, a V, you could say, then that's valine. You put one more carbon in between the V and where it attach at the side chain position, then that's an isobutyl group, and that is leucine. Ooh, I forgot to leave myself room here, but that's okay. As was brought up in lecture, there are these abbreviations for amino acids. Alanine happens to be abbreviated ALA. Valine, V-A-L, leucine, L-E-W. So they're logical. The one-letter abbreviations happen to be logical in this case as well. A for alanine, V for valine. L for leucine, and let me scoop back down here. Glycine, it's GLY or G. And I think, wow, those seem pretty simple. Unfortunately, there's some amino acids that have the same starting letter, and so some amino acids don't just have the one-letter abbreviation you might expect. Now, I'm just showing you this for convenience sake. And for later on when we do get into protein chains, because if a protein contains a few thousand amino acids, let's just say, for argument's sake, it's a lot less space to represent them by one-letter abbreviations than writing out the sequence of names over and over and over again. So that's why we have the abbreviations. But we won't memorize them. Now, the point of the lecture today is to get to where we can join two amino acids together in one of these peptide chains. So first, let me explain a little terminology there. Polypeptide is an amino acid polymer, which is a protein. For each polypeptide, there's what's known as the sequence, which is the order of amino acids found in a polypeptide. If you can remember the term amino acid, then you can remember which way the sequence works, because you start from the amino end of the molecule and name towards the carboxylic acid end. So you name from the amino end towards the acid end. So imagine that we had the following. If we had what did we do this morning? Valine, alanine, leucine, which could be abbreviated VAL, ALA, LU, or VAL. What would that molecule look like? Or first, what is it? Well, this is an example of a tripeptide. Tripeptide means contains three amino acids. And so here's what that tripeptide would look like. Now notice the backbone, the type of connection that we have between the amino acid residue. Sometimes that's the term used. And this is an amide linkage. Relatively unreactive. That's something we should hope for, because that means that amino acids or proteins stick together under rather harsh conditions. It means we literally don't fall apart. So there's two of these amide linkages, but in the chain, each unit only has three atoms. So notice as we go from amino acid unit to the next, the direction I'm writing the carbonyl flip-flops, just because I'm trying to maintain this zigzag structure that we default to. Then, because of that, that means from each amino acid to the next, if I write one with a dash, the next one, the R group's written with a wedge, and then a dash, and back and forth, and back and forth. So this is why you need to have some ability to write amino acids in multiple ways. So there is a tripeptide, and now the rest of the lecture is, how could we synthesize something like this? So the first approach I'll take is to say, what if we just wanted to put two amino acids together? And then we'll talk about a modification that uses an important development known as the Merrifield resin, what's known as a polymer support synthesis. We'll see why it's, well, for chemists, super cool in just a second. Having already taught this to sections 1 and 3, however, I realize there is a limiting reagent in this discussion, which is, how do you make an amide? Now, if you remember the answer right away, hold on to it for a moment. But I'll ask the whole group again. How does one make an amide in general? Because we're trying to make amide bonds to link these amino acids together. But I couldn't get anybody to tell me how to make an amide in the other two sections. It might be helpful to remind us that we did have carboxylic acids this quarter and not last quarter, even though it might feel like amino acids were, or carboxylic acids were, a million years ago. In other words, this is going to be a rough final if you all don't start reviewing your carboxylic acids soon. Yes? We could make an acyl halide, couldn't we? There we go. So, if, for example, we had acetic acid, we could react it with thionyl chloride, which will get us acetyl chloride. Which, yes, then we could react with some kind of amine. In order to make an amide. Okay? Will this approach work as well with amino acids? Let's see. So, I gave us this example of valine, alanine, leucine. Let's say I just try to put valine and alanine together. Since I want valine's carboxylic acid end to be connected to alanine's amino end, I'm going to make the carboxylic acid of valine the acyl halide, because that's the way I want the direction to occur. Let me put some terminology up here on this tripeptide I wrote. Because we do have two different ends of the polypeptide, and sometimes the word terminus or terminal is used to describe the different ends. So on the right-hand side, we could call this the acid terminal or terminus. Sometimes it's called the C-terminal or terminus. Because the main functional group there, carboxylic acid, has carbon as the center of it. At the opposite end, We have the amino terminus, or the N terminus, terminus, terminal. I don't think there's a difference. I think one's Latin, one's English. Mean the same thing. The end point. So, I want the acid terminus of valine to react with the amino terminus of aline. So I'll take valine. React it with thionyl chloride. And I'll end up with a mess. Even before I get a chance to react it with alanine. Why? Because the molecules die functional. It could react with its own self even before I put the alanine in. That's why I get a huge mess. And that's why that you can't do a direct, easy dipeptide synthesis by the same techniques they would use to make a plain old amide. So amino acids are difunctional. As such, they cannot be easily joined together. Without the use of protecting groups. So if we wanted to do the following, which notice my use of abbreviations. Since you're going to be writing the structures of amino acids over and over and over and over again, at some point it becomes simpler just to simplify the structures in this way. Because once you've shown the correct structure for valine once, do I really feel like sitting down and reading all of your exams and to say, okay, that stereocenter is still correct. Is it still correct? Is it still correct? Is it still correct? Is it still correct? Missed the stereocenter in that one little bit. You know, in principle, I should, but if I'm just trying to focus on the bigger picture of do you know how to synthesize one of these dipeptide chains, then I make everybody else's life easier, including mine, actually, by doing these simplifications. So I recommend this, in fact, and your questions, though, will be carefully worded to say something along the lines of you have to show your structure once before you abbreviate it. Yeah?
Amide can be synthesized just making it to acetyl halide.
Even if we had some way of synthesizing a dipeptide without making an acyl halide,
just directly
that only works well, though, if you heat them up. So Leonardi's bringing up the point, hey, we don't technically need thionyl chloride to make an amide. Well, no, technically not. But recognize that if you took a carboxylic acid and amine, put them together, they're just going to neutralize each other. Because the amine's a base, the acid's an acid. But if you take that salt and you heat it and you dehydrate it, you could end up with an amide. It is a valid synthesis, but it requires heat. And if you have side groups on these amino acid chains, that ends up being a problem. We're actually going to see a totally different reagent you hadn't seen before that's not just using amino acid synthesis, but is very useful here because it does allow joining amino acids under much gentler conditions. But let me bring up the point where we're going to see with this protecting group strategy. So we're going to do two things. For one amino acid, we're going to protect its nitrogen, do N protection. For the other one, we're going to protect the carboxylic acid group, which that's C protection. So that leaves only these two functional groups able to react. So by protecting the N-terminus of one amino acid and the C-terminus of the other, two amino acids can be joined in a specific way. Now let's see what the reagents we could use to protect them are, and then let's look at this alternate reagent for doing the coupling of two amino acids together. So first we'll cover N protection, because that's the step that you're doing today. N protection involves a molecule that's called ditert-butyl dicarbonate. It also, for reasons that you'll see later on, is called Bach anhydride. So carbonate is a structure where you have two oxygens on a carbonyl. Dicarbonate is where you join two carbonates together, which if you did it in the way that I have shown here, what kind of functional group do we have in the middle of this dicarbonate? An anhydride. The ditert-butyl part of the name means that on each end of this dicarbonate, we have a T-butyl group. Why do we use such a funky molecule? Because whenever we use a protecting group, we need an easy way to remove it. It turns out that T-butyl groups can be more easily hydrolyzed than other esters. And we're going to take advantage of that later on, but let me not get too much ahead of ourselves. Let's first use it before we see how to remove it. We're going to use it based on this reactivity that it is an anhydride. So hopefully you remember that if we take an anhydride and react it with something, in a symmetric anhydride like this, you just take one half the molecule, get rid of it, and you attach whatever would react at the position where this oxygen is located. We're going to use this to protect the amino end of valine, because I'm trying to join valine to alanine in this direction as shown. I need to protect the end portion of the valine. So I'll throw valine at it. Now, valine is difunctional still. So which group, the amino or the acid group, is going to react with the anhydride? The amino end? Yes, because an acid group wants to get attacked by a base. A base wants to attack an acid, whether we're talking about Bronsted-Lowry or Lewis acids and bases. An anhydride likes to be attacked by alcohols and amines. Have I shown you an example of an anhydride reacting with an acid? No. Is it impossible? No. But think about this. In order for an anhydride to react, something has to attack that carbonyl. What's more likely to attack the carbonyl? The oxygen of a carboxylic acid or the basic nitrogen of an amino group? Basic nitrogen of the amino group. So you're only going to get one product out of this. And yes, I'm not showing you the full mechanism, and that's okay. Okay, now if this is valine, I forgot to put the V. So go put that back on if you were looking down for a moment. So I protected the amino group. Often this protection is abbreviated. So you could say TBOC itself. And now that amino acid is ready to be joined. So let's move to C protection. Which one of the simplest ways to protect, which you'll be doing in this lab, is to make an ester. Because we know that we can reversibly produce esters. So in this case, we'll take alanine, because that's the one we do want to protect that carboxylic acid end. Do a classic Fischer esterification with methanol and acid. And now that end is protected. We're now ready to
So for C, this is alcohol, right?
In this case, it's just an alcohol. Now, this is not necessarily the best choice. There are other esters that could be more easily cleaved even than this one. But part of the reason I'm not going to get into that is because we're not, other than the lab, really going to be using this procedure for joining only two amino acids together. Generally, if we're bothering to join amino acids, we're making larger peptide chains. So what we're leading up to is how do we deal with multiple amino acids being linked together. But now that we've got the two amino acids, the protected ones, let's join them. And we're going to use a reagent called DCC, which stands for dicyclohexyl. Carbodiimide. Now, why this is called a diimide, I'm not entirely sure, because to me it looks like a diimine. However, I do know that this will eventually turn into a carboxylic acid derivative. And in fact, it's the decomposition of DCC into a really stable carboxylic acid derivative that drives the reaction forward. What's the structure of DCC? Notice those are cyclohexane rings, not benzene rings. Some people get too much in the habit from Chem 12B of filling in their hexagons. So this is really truly cyclohexyl. And I could use the amino acids, and I did in the other two lectures. But if I'm trying to focus on mechanism, and I'm using these big amino acids to do it with, it makes it kind of hard to see the mechanism itself. So I'm going to switch to an easier set of molecules. And I'll say, imagine that we have some kind of carboxylic acid and some kind of amine that we want to join together. If I were to throw DCC into a solution with one or the other of these two compounds, the carboxylic acid or the amine, which one do you think DCC would actually have the chance to react with? With the acid, why? Because it has what?
Carbon dioxide. The amine can attack the carbon.
It's probably not as likely. Maybe it's not impossible, but it wouldn't be the first thing that would happen. Why not? Because the nitrogen with a lone pair is a base, and we have a carboxylic acid. So yes, they would just simply neutralize each other at first. And that is the first step of this mechanism. The first step of this mechanism. That's right. So acid-base neutralization. We make a carboxylic acid salt, which can react again with this protonated DCC to push the carbon-nitrogen, or one of the carbon-nitrogen double bonds, open. Now, it might not be immediately obvious, but I had said a moment ago that the decomposition of this DCC is what helps push this reaction forward. The DCC, once it's attached like this, effectively acts as a leaving group with the oxygen. So we haven't made an acyl halide, but we've made something that acts like an acyl halide. So, I won't show a proper mechanism, but I'll just point out that at this point, that effectively what's going to happen is that amino group is going to attack the carboxylic acid. So this is like we were trying to do, you might not have heard this term from me, aminolysis. Which means react a carboxylic acid derivative with an amine in order to make an amine. So generally we haven't been doing that, but this is one case where this shows up. The reason this can happen is because this is not an ester really like it looks like. This thing attached at the ester position is more reactive than just an alkyl group. So that's the driving force for this reaction. I've said that a couple times now. And this is not a true full mechanism. Because if this amino group did attack, you need a protonation somewhere and a deprotonation somewhere else. Because the carboxylic acid, if it gets pushed open, we make a negatively charged oxygen. So that needs to gain a proton. The amine is neutral to begin with, but after attacks, it's positively charged, so it needs to lose a proton. So multiple steps, though, if I want to simplify, and I get the following. Take a moment to look at that. It's kind of complicated. But at the bottom of the page, you can see that there is a carbon that's got two oxygens and a nitrogen attached all at the same time. That is this thing that looks like an ester in the middle of being aminolized. You notice that I've written six of these atoms to suggest a ring, which I hadn't seen this concerted form of mechanism before, but I'm going to go ahead and draw it so it'll match what your textbook shows. In other texts, it tends to show these as separate events. But here's what essentially happens. The DCC group ends up coming off with the oxygen as a leaving group. Because it is favorable for the carbonyl to form by pushing over the carbon-nitrogen double bond, which the lone pair of nitrogen in response can grab the neighboring hydrogen, which losing that hydrogen helps this other side of the molecule also form a carbonyl. So it is a paracyclic reaction in this case. We get two things as a result. The amide that we want, plus this decomposed byproduct of DCC. Speak maybe without a code in my nose. So, this is the reagent DCC, which is used to avoid using harsh reagents like thionyl chloride. Because if you notice, we didn't need any external acid or base sources. We just needed the carboxylic acid itself that we started with to initiate this process. And so this can be executed with fairly mild conditions. And it is a very efficient reaction, meaning it has a high percent yield. So, bringing this back to our dipeptide discussion, we could take the Bach-protected valine plus the esterified aniline, or not aniline, alanine. And join them together by DCC. Which I'm going to unabbreviate the Bach side, because it's going to react momentarily. What we're going to do next is undo the protections. Or I'll show you the ND protection at least. So this is the acid, trifluoroacetic acid. Now, has anyone got enough geek cred that they would know the pKa of acetic acid offhand? 4.76. That's for the Ka. But pKa, yes, is 4.76. Now, 4.6, oh, but you're trying to think trifluoroacetic acid itself. You're anticipating the next question, which is how would the fluorines affect the pKa value? Inductive effect, which means it makes it more acidic, and so we get a pKa of? I think it's 0.23 maybe for this molecule. Somewhere around zero, which means a pretty strong acid, which we don't necessarily use in concentrated form. It turns out, though, that the T-butyl group is very hydrolyzable acid compared to other esters. So with the trifluoroacetic acid, what happens is we knock off the T-butyl group. Simplifying with an R group momentarily, I want to point out that the process doesn't stop here. Because does this structure look familiar to you at all? This is one of those carboxylic acid forms that's not thermodynamically stable. Remember that anytime we have a carboxylic acid, we're on the other side of the carbonyl. There's also a heteroatom. Those molecules are not isolatable normally. So if we had OH, that would be carbonic acid. And this is a carbamic acid, a derivative, that's going to decarboxylate. That leaves us with a now unprotected amino end. So we've unmasked half of this dipeptide. And I'm not going to show you the reagent for the methanol because we're not going to do it exactly. I'll just make the comment that esters are more reactive than amines, so if you're careful about it, you could hydrolyze a methyl ester and, in theory, not affect the rest of the molecule. But wanting to put the focus on multiple amino acids being assembled, let's switch to that. Then after that, we'll be ready for the lab, after just a little commentary on safety. So, to make a tripeptide, or larger molecule, we use what's known as a Merrifield resin. Now, let me explain the practical reasons why we do this. Yes, I showed you a route that could be used to synthesize a dipeptide. And notice that we have a bare amino end. If we had another N-protected amino acid, we could link it to what we've got right here and make a tripeptide. D-protect the amino group, DCC another protected amino acid, and keep doing it over and over and over again. But there becomes a real-life problem, which is you're making bigger and bigger and bigger molecules that become less and less and less soluble in anything, at least easily. So there becomes a synthetic problem, a practical problem of not being able to deal with these compounds once they get too big. And that's where this Merrifield resin synthesis comes in, because it reduces the issues of purification in a very sneaky, cool way. So to start out talking about this, we need to know what the resin is. Resin is kind of like a polymer. And this particular one is a derivative of styrene. So first, what is styrene? Benzene ring with a double bond on it, right. It turns out that styrene is a very reactive molecule. So in either a strong acid source, like aluminum trichloride, or if we had a Grignard reagent, which is a strong base source. Or if we had light that causes the formation of radicals, under acid, basic, or radical conditions, you can get styrene to polymerize. And what happens is one alkene unit attaches to the next, so you get these increments of two carbons, and on the second of each of those carbons, we're going to have a phenyl group on it. And that is polystyrene. Which, yes, depending on exactly how you do this, is going to end up making what looks like little beads, just like the stuff that's in styrofoam cups. Now, what if we did a variation of this? What if we took two different, what are called monomers? So if polymer means multiple molecules being strung together, the monomer is the individual molecule that goes into making it up. And notice I'm taking styrene now with a different functionalized styrene. Does anybody happen to remember what name is used to describe this kind of position that I've just circled? Not its relative geometry across the benzene ring, but if I refer to that just specific position, a carbon that is attached to a benzene ring and something attached to that carbon, what is that position called? Don't remember our vinyl and allyl terms from many moons ago? Asparge, a good guess, but that's for a triple bond. But that's rare that people remember that one. How about benzyl? Benzyl halides are great substrates for both SN1 and SN2 reactions. So how are we going to use that? Well, let me show you the rest of this talk about the resin, and we'll get there. So we have some kind of way of initiating polymerization. If we have time to talk about polymers, we may come back and talk about whether one then the other form of styrene gets taken into the chain, or whether there's blocks of regular styrene followed by blocks of the derivative type stuff, which that's called a block copolymer. But for right now, it doesn't really matter. All we need to know is this is a functionalized polymer bead. Little sphere. Again, think of it like crushed up styrofoam cups. So why is this kind of substrate so useful? So I'm going to simplify this with a P for polymer. But everybody remember that the very first thing that's abbreviated is a benzene ring. There's a benzene ring next to this methyl position, so it's a benzyl group. That helps us understand this, that if we were trying to do a longer peptide synthesis, then what I was describing earlier is the approach we still would take, where we protect the carbon end of one molecule and attach an amino acid to the amino end, and then attach another one to its amino end, and so on and so forth. So if we had this big, long amino acid chain, whatever is the end of the chain is the first thing that we put on the polymer. So way back when, it seems like yesterday's lecture already, I was talking about this tripeptide, valine, alanine, leucine that I wanted to synthesize. So if I want to synthesize that particular tripeptide, I'm going to put leucine onto this polymer support first. How am I going to do that? Use sodium hydroxide to deprotonate the leucine. You make a carboxylate, which is not that basic, but it's basic enough to be able to do an SN2 reaction on the polymer chain. Why is this so magical? Because when you're done, pour the beads into a cup, filter out the solution, wash off the beads, throw them back in the reaction, do the next one. Because your product is attached to these beads, anything else that didn't get attached is just byproduct, and so you wash it away. And so that you're guaranteed to just have this one amino acid sitting on that polymer bead. So now when you throw that bead at the next solution, then you add one more molecule on. Pull the beads out of solution, you've got your product automatically. You can do this over and over and over again, something like 25 times at least, if your technique is really good, or like they have done now, if you make the whole process automated. So, how do we finish this off? Same type of approach we were using up above. We're going to take, and to save a little bit of time and room, let's say that we already have an array of Bach-protected amino acids. So I've now got leucine on here. The next one I would want to put on is alanine. So I'm going to take Bach-protected alanine. Which has its carboxylic acid in free. I'm going to take that with the leucine, who has its free amino group ready to react. And I'm going to join them by DCC. Now, I didn't give section one this warning. But they're gonna get the warning. This problem of making a tripeptide, or a problem like it, has been either on a test or a final for all of time that I've been teaching Chem 12C. As you can see, even in this abbreviated form, it takes a little while to write this out. If you do not practice this at least once before the exam, you won't finish the exam in the amount of time I'm gonna give you. And I'm going to tell you that the amount of time I'm going to give you is based on you practicing. That is the only reason that even if you had those 10 minutes that you should have had for your exam, it's the only reason in my mind that you didn't finish. Not because there are too many questions, but I'm guessing for most of you, you hadn't practiced, so it just took you too long. You knew what you were doing, just couldn't do it in time. So I'm just warning you that proficiency is one of the things being assessed on exam 3. Meaning if you don't practice, you won't finish. And that, having given this warning, won't be my problem. Am I pretty clear about that? In other words, if it takes you half an hour to write out what I'm about to write out, it's too long. And it is long. It's a lot that I'm writing. But if I didn't talk during it, I could blaze through this and get one of these ripped out in maybe 3-4 minutes. I'll time myself, just to be fair, and write it out where you can actually read it. I'll time myself. And I'll use that as my judge of how much time you should have. Of course, we're not quite done, because if I'm making a tripeptide, I've only made a dipeptide so far. So trifluoroacetic acid will hydrolyze the T-butyl ester, which will then release a derivatized carbamic acid, which decarboxylates, which means we end up with the amino group free again. Now, I am thinking about test-taking strategies, because once, just in the same way that I said, once you abbreviate amino acid, why do you have to write its structure over and over again? Once you made a dipeptide, do you really need to show the full structure of the dipeptide over and over again? No. So maybe I'll think about it and give us all a logical way to abbreviate this. But since we have abbreviated, now we could take the next amino acid, which is the first amino acid, which still must be Bach protected. I'm just waiting for the bad Bach to the future jokes. Since it's going to take me a minute to write this, I'll fill in the space by saying, for those of you that have some classical Western music knowledge, you know there's Bach and all of his children, then there's Offenbach. So you have Bach, Offenbach, often not Bach. Definitely not Bach. Yes. And for those of you who didn't get it, that's okay, because I'm done drawing the polymer now. So now I've got three amino acids on that polymer chain. If I wanted to add yet another amino acid, I could use trifluoroacetic acid again. Just so I don't write the whole darn structure again, at this point I would have the tripeptide but stuck on the polymer B. This mechanism, I don't know. I want to find out because benzyl groups do funny things, and one of the funny things that happens with benzyl ethers like this, or benzyl esters, is you can cleave them with HF. So once you've cleaved it, then we've got our released tripeptide. That's the Merrifield resin synthesis. What are we going to be doing in today's lab? Not the Merrifield resin synthesis, but a dipeptide synthesis, and we are going to be using Bach anhydride to protect the amino group of alanine. So we are going to be using one of the amino acids that have been showing up here, and we are using Bach anhydride. In case some of you hadn't done your prelab, then you didn't read the big, huge, fat warning note about Bach anhydride, which says don't breathe it in and minimize your contact as much as possible. Fortunately, it's a liquid, which means we don't need to bring it out here to the balances to measure out. So do as it recommends and keep that Bach anhydride in the fume hood as much as possible, because it is an anhydride and it is a T-butyl ester, both of which are reactive around water, and you contain an awful lot of water or alcohol groups in your air passages. So if you don't want to Bach all your air passages, don't break all this stuff in. That's why there's the big warning note to be careful with the Bach anhydride. It also has a warning note about the 3-molar, is it hydrochloric or sodium hydroxide or both that you're using. But that's the same type of warning we've had all quarter long, so I just want to emphasize to treat the Bach carefully. I want to also point out a logistical note that has now come up more than once, and I'm I'm so ready to do something about it, which is that over here on the cart where there are acids and bases, yeah, it happened again this morning. And it happened again even right after I yelled at them about it happened. Section one, if you don't remember, there was a bottle of sodium hydroxide on the top shelf there, which is never, ever acceptable. It's all acids on that top shelf. So you take the bottle somewhere else with it. But people were too lazy to do that, or there was too much of a crowd. That I can understand. But they left the sodium hydroxide there. Or we're measuring it out right next to all these acids. So I came over and said, pointed at the sign that says top tray acids only and said, does this make sense what you all are doing? I came back 10 minutes later, the bottle was still there, which means I'd just been blown off. So not only were they doing it wrong, but they blew off my warning about doing it wrong. Yeah, that's never good with an instructor in a mood. So I'm just warning you all, I'll be looking out for that. And if the last quarter is the first quarter where I start taking points off because this keeps happening, so be it. I'm happy with that. I don't know if the rest of you will. So, you're going to do everything half quantity. And because of how long of a lab lecture you have, you likely won't have more time than to measure everything out and do your 45-minute heating and stirring that you need to. If that's all you get through today, that's okay. If that is all you get through to today, make sure that you cap and label. Don't just use parafilm. A couple people this morning were trying to use parafilm, and that stuff just is not a sealing agent. It is a backup sealing agent. So make sure you use a proper septum or greased glass stopper to store your material for today. And then we're just going to continue with this lab, and then the next lab, and the next lab after that for the rest of the quarter. So if you want to get a head on your pre-labs, then yes, we're just going to be carrying through half quantity the four labs that make up this dipeptide sequence. Any questions?